From the PA Foundation, I'm James Millward. This is Vital Minds, a podcast connecting the most vital issues in clinical care with the top minds facing them every day. As medical professionals, we are all aware of the critical role that nutrition plays in our patients' health. When we look at issues like childhood obesity and chronic conditions like heart disease or diabetes, what a person eats plays a very central role. But according to research, how a person eats can be just as important. With me today is Dr. Chris Taylor, PhD in Nutritional Sciences of The Ohio State University, and Ashlyn Smith, PAC, who practices in endocrinology in Arizona. Chris has extensively studied the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, the NHANES, which is part of a program of studies designed to assess the health and nutrition status of adults and children throughout the United States. What makes a survey especially interesting is that it actually combines both patient interviews and physical examinations, so you get the whole picture. Now, Ashlyn has made a shift in how she frames the diet and lifestyle conversation with her patients in her endocrinology practice as a result of the NHANES report. Thank you both for joining us today to talk about nutrition.
Thank you for having me, James. I appreciate looking at this topic. It's definitely an important topic and close to my heart.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Now, Dr. Taylor, I am always interested to learn how our guests became interested in their chosen specialties. So why nutrition?
Well, when I was growing up, I ran cross country in junior high and high school. And our coach was always one of those people that said you have to have everything in line. So you have to come to practice ready to train. You have to have your school life together, your family life. And he always kind of harped on us eating well. So he was always telling us, you need to pack your satchel before we go to these meets. And his favorite phrase was, you can't run a top fuel dragster on low lead gas. I heard about the opportunity for dietetics and nutrition as a career option. And with all that background of what they trained us on and all these workshops I'd been to as a runner myself, it just really solidified that idea. That's a way that you can really impact people's health and overall well-being with something we have to do every day.
Definitely. Now, Ashlyn, your specialty is endocrinology, right? And you've taken a nutrition-focused approach with your patients. Now, why for you have you found it to be so important to focus on nutrition when treating our patients with chronic illnesses?
So nutrition applies directly to endocrinology for a few different reasons. Obviously, the role in metabolic diseases is quite well established, but I've found that addressing nutrition can actually have a significant impact on the patient's overall health trajectory and their quality of life. And in a different way, this actually can empower patients to enact change in their health so they can be a more active member of their healthcare team, and that can be quite valuable.
That makes a lot of sense. Nutrition can definitely be one of those undiscussed things that when you bring it up changes a lot for your patient.
Absolutely. I think in medicine, we've veered away from the idea of food as medicine. And there really aren't any quote-unquote side effects for incorporating nutritional changes.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, you both are obviously very familiar with the NHANES data. And Dr. Taylor, I know you and your group have studied it very extensively. So for those listening who maybe are not as familiar with the NHANES data, can you tell us why it is so important and what the value is here?
The NHANES data has actually been collected for a very extended period of time. They started collecting it back in the 70s, and they'd do it in the early 70s in this little wave, and then they'd stop. Then they started collecting again in the late 70s, and then they had NHANES 3 in 88 to 94. Then they started up again in 1999 as a continuous pattern of collecting data because they found out, one, every time they stopped collecting data, they were losing information. But it was a way of keeping track of these trends of health concerns, weight status, nutritional habits, inflammation, all of these different factors that are related to health. They're being collected on this essentially en masse across the U.S. to keep a finger on the pulse of the health and nutritional status. So we know the CDC growth charts that came out in 2000. Those CDC growth charts were based on the NHANES 3 or 88 to 94 growth data of children in the U.S. So they collected all of the heights and weights and BMIs of those kids along with their age And they basically normed that data to the U.S. distribution of what's the 50th percentile for weight to generate that. So this data has been paramount in really being able to identify where our gaps are, where our challenges are, and really it's used a lot to keep track of how are we doing on our Healthy People 2010 and 2020 guidelines, recommendations of where we want to be. It's a way of keeping track of how these happen. And it's very rich in the nutritional data as well with the dietary intakes. And that's really where I'd spend a lot of my time is digesting, no pun intended, what people are actually eating.
From the research perspective on this, it sounds like it's a fairly unique data of body, especially with how long-term this has been going on. How consistently are they collecting new data?
So the way that it has carried on, they used to have the old longer waves of NHANES that were 3 to 4 years at a time, and they collect the same information and then kind of stop and gather. When they started up in 1999, they wanted to take many of those same things that they've carried over from the past. So there's the demographic information they collect. They have the physical exam that's everything from height and weight to hearing to vision to all sorts of different physical exams. They collect several tubes of blood to then be able to do blood and urine analysis for the biochemistry piece. A bunch of questionnaires that give you this data about everything from home ownership to health insurance to healthcare utilization, food security, a whole battery of things from that side. And then the dietary intake. And the dietary intake has been it used to be a 1 day of food recall, which gives you a snapshot. Now they're up to 2 days, one on the day of their visit to these four tractor trailers that travel around the country. And then now they're collecting one via telephone within a week later. So when they started in 1999, they were going in 2 year waves. So they collect information for 2 years, then they'd reassess and say, are there things we need to add? Are there things we need to take away? So vitamin D has been one of those things that's kind of come into the forefront and has been something that's been added to the lab values, to the dietary data and things like that, and reassessed. Where some other things that are less prevalent or less of a concern have kind of started to fade away a little bit. So the data is collected now on about 10,000 people every 2 year cycle. So every time you get that 2 year cycle, you're getting demographic, questionnaire, personal characteristics, lab values, and dietary intake on 10,000 people that you can use to really look at questions that are very pertinent to our health status.
Ashlyn, from a patient care perspective, nutrition is so important to discuss, but it can actually be hard to bring up. Why do you find that is?
Discussing nutrition can be somewhat daunting for clinicians and even patients too. It's pretty complex, it's time consuming, and it has a lot of factors that we have to take into account, not the least of which are finances, family dynamics, education barriers. Then we have to account for dietary fads, some misconceptions about nutrition. So some clinicians may be hesitant to open that Pandora's box of the nutrition discussion.
Now, when we talk about data with our patients when it comes to nutrition, how can the NHANES project help facilitate these conversations with our patients?
One piece that's quite valuable about looking at the NHANES data is to help to understand population trends. And for patients, this can actually help somewhat normalize the conversation about nutrition. So we can find talking points from the NHANES data that can make what the patient is going through seem a little bit more kind of commonplace. For example, we can say things like many people struggle with skipping meals. Many people struggle with snacking frequently or their quality of snacks. Is that something that you find that we could work on as well? It helps for patients to understand that they're not the only ones going through this, and it helps give us those specific talking points to start that discussion with patients. And this also helps to kind of remove some of the burden of blame that a discussion about lifestyle intervention can have and help the patients understand that we are on their team.
I think that makes a lot of sense, especially when you show patients how common some of these things are that everyone is kind of dealing with at the same time. And it makes it much less of a burden to the patient to think they have to change so much.
Absolutely. They're not alone in this. They're not the only ones going through this. And I think that it helps to let them know that.
Well, one of the things about nutrition is, in comparison to other sciences like chemistry, we hear about all the Greek philosophers that are doing all this in chemistry and all the geometry and all those things that date back so far. Nutrition as a science, in comparison, is in its infancy. So we spend a lot of time kind of focused on nutrients and then how much of those and how those play in each individual's element. So our science for nutrition has been evolving from somewhat of a myopic approach in looking at how all of these individual factors are related to the overall health. And now we have to translate that into what does that mean for the diet. So we talk about cholesterol, we talk about calcium, but people don't eat the nutrients, they eat the foods. And we've spent so much of our time looking at average calories for weight loss. So you need to reduce your calories. Well, 1,000 calories of cookies versus 1,000 calories of fruits and vegetables are very different ways of eating. And they have lots of different profiles. So that's where I think the NHANES has really been helpful from my perspective. I always say a lot of the stuff I do isn't rocket science, but it gets us beyond what we're commonly doing of taking average calories and saying, where are those calories coming from? What foods are they consuming? What foods are they not consuming? When are they eating their meals? What are their meals make up? Now those kinds of things give us that much deeper insight. So instead of saying, you need to reduce your caloric intake, we can say, we need to focus on reducing our caloric intake in these particular areas. So when I've been talking to my primary care collaborator, he tells stories about how working with patients and trying to give them advice. And we joke that in primary care, he says he's got somebody who needs to reduce what they're eating. He says, you need to eat less calories. And they say, okay, how should I do that? They say, yes, you should. So sometimes we know what we need to tell them, but we don't always know exactly what to tell them to do. And a lot of the work that we're able to do with NHANES, because we get every food they consume and the nutrients and when and where they got it and all of that, it gives us a lot more information that we can understand what people eat, not just how much.
Now, Ashlyn, how do you in your practice apply kind of the data, the conclusions of the NHANES type projects into your own practice?
It has helped me individualize some of the recommendations using the NHANES data for our patients. So we set very specific goals for areas that they can improve. And a particular area that I talk about beyond what I've already addressed, beyond skipping meals and the snacking, is identifying protein intake. That was one area that really came out with the NHANES data, that many adults are under consuming the amount of protein that they should, and that's even below the 0.8 grams per kilogram per day that many of us think actually is quite low. One thing that can be quite helpful is discussing protein intake, because we talk so much about what patients shouldn't eat. We don't necessarily talk about what they should be eating. So I want to make sure that my patients are avoiding this relative malnutrition where they're cutting back so much and they're missing some of those key nutrients.
You know, I can say I see that myself in our practice. I'm in cardiovascular surgery, and we have a lot of patients that postoperatively protein intake is very important for healing. It's very important for their recovery and for reconditioning their bodies. And it is amazing to me how often the patients come in and have to be told that they need to be eating more protein, and you have to go through the very, you know, specific things with them. But once you give them goals, it's very easy for them to change the behaviors and get on board.
Absolutely. So recovery from illness, surgery, that's definitely a time of high protein need, and they might need to increase even as much as 1.2 grams. And I agree that many people aren't aware of the impact that protein intake can play with that. So I'm glad that you're addressing that as well. That's wonderful.
Now, it's not always about what or when you're eating, but what's happening in your life around you that might be leading you to engage in certain nutritional behaviors or habits. Dr. Taylor, when you have looked over the data, how do social determinants come into play here with our nutrition?
Social determinants of health is actually one of these areas where I think NHANES gives us some of that capacity to really explore what's going on. We've done a lot of research where we're looking at food security status, which commonly is defined as high food security, which means no concerns about having access to food and things like that. And then there are four levels, which go all the way down to very low food secure, which is normally what we kind of assume with poverty and things like that. But we're able to look at the food sources, where people get their food. What types of food are people eating across these differing levels of food security status? Because it's one thing to say everyone's got access to a store, but what can you afford within that store, and how do those choices then help make those decisions? What type of restaurants? From the paper we had recently in the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior, we were looking at what were the food source locations and the diet quality from those places. And the people that were high food secure were buying better diet quality foods in the grocery store than those that were buying them with low food secure, or very low food secure. So how we utilize what we have really tells us an awful lot. But also, when we looked at restaurants, those that were in the high food secure group, they did eat at fast food, but they also had most of their kind of dining out experiences at more of a casual dining type of a restaurant. Where it was reversed for those that were less food secure, they were more likely to be reliant on a fast casual or fast food kind of location than the other. And those menus will be very different and the options very different and being able to eat healthy. So those things become very important when we have to tell somebody who's got heart failure, now you need to reduce your sodium and take your medication. Well, now it might come down to a choice of affording their medication or affording food, which then means they eat something high in sodium because it's cheaper and they can afford it. And now they're right back in the hospital again because they've had a bout from their high sodium intake, which is nothing about medication management as it is about lifestyle management, moderated by their social determinants of health.
Now, diet and lifestyle conversations, as we know, can be some of the most difficult to have with our patients, especially those who realize and recognize that their diet is influencing their health, but they find it very difficult to change their eating habits. Sometimes it's all about knowing the right way to approach this. Ashlyn, how do you get there with your patients during a typical visit?
I usually start with a more open-ended question, like, tell me about your meals on a typical day. So I have them start with breakfast, and then I ask about snacks and so on and so forth. So I'll ask, between breakfast and lunch, is there a snack? Between lunch and dinner, is there a snack? And this usually helps me gauge where they are in terms of their nutritional education, as well as perhaps some efforts that they've tried in the past in terms of augmenting their nutrition. And then that helps me to gauge where we need to go. So maybe the nutritional education is a little bit more basic, then we need to start with foundations versus somebody who's telling me macronutrient amounts, we can go in a different direction. If they are a bit unsure about how to answer the general question, then I'll ask things like, tell me about how often you eat out or eat fast food. Tell me about some of the diets that you've tried in the past to prompt their answers a little bit more readily. Sometimes that helps trigger some ideas about their nutrition. But generally, I start off pretty open-ended, and that helps direct our conversation.
Now, how well does patient follow-up go with you with these types of visits? What kind of timing do you feel like is important? And how are you seeing patients come back?
So there's usually a good mix, some who are pretty diligent and do follow up as recommended, and others maybe not so much. In general, if we're following a specific metabolic illness, say we're watching diabetes, I'll want to see how some of these nutritional recommendations are affecting their blood sugar. So I might follow them at 1 month versus if we're trying to just increase their overall strength or we're doing dietary intervention for osteoporosis or osteopenia, I would give them a few more months. In general, a motivated patient is likely to come back, and I do think it's important to set those follow-up expectations because we want to follow up and see how the patient has been able to succeed and what areas they might still be struggling in. And invariably, questions pop up that they may not may not think to pick up the phone and ask, but if they come in to have that discussion, they're much more likely to talk about it. And I even document inside my notes specific goals that we have set for patients. So, for instance, going to work on not eating out as much or going to work on stopping soda, whatever it is that we've set, those couple of goals, so that when they come back in, I can follow up with that specific recommendation.
That's understandable. Nutrition is often that piece of medicine that is so often ignored. Now, when it comes to PAs that are trying to be a part of the solution and improving nutrition and the health of our patients, how can the NHANES data be a tool to help us?
So the NHANES data gives researchers the opportunity to really kind of go in and dissect the what people are eating, what's available to individuals, how they're utilizing that food for their health. And it gives us an insight into people's eating habits that we can now take with us to the bedside to say, all right, we've got a patient coming in. We know that if we have issues with actually protein intakes in middle-aged and older adults. Well, we might not assume middle-aged is having some of those concerns, but our data recently are showing protein needs are actually not being met as well in our 50 to 60-year-olds, which are working age and that sort. So it now clues us into, here's something that seems to be an issue within this target population. Now it helps frame those types of conversations. How are you eating around these things? How we can get into questions about social determinants of health and start asking about, you know, how are you doing with your eating? And, you know, have you been able to meet the goals that you have for yourself? Which doesn't mean you have to set goals for them, but it starts the conversation and can facilitate those. A lot of times the patients that we had in this and some of the studies we've done, they weren't really ready to do a dietary intervention until the doctor said, you're eligible for this study and you can get nutrition counseling. And I think that's important for you. And at that stage, now someone has brought it up as a priority. So if we can utilize what we see are related lifestyle factors and bring those forward to our patients and ask how they're doing, that might be the gateway to get them started and taking action.
So as we talked about, nutrition is kind of that unsung hero in medicine. I think that PAs are in a unique position to be leaders in the medical community from a nutrition management perspective, and we can use the data and the tools that we learned from the NHANES data to enact some of that change. PAs are often able to have more time and have a little bit more rapport with patients. Thankfully, we do have that, so we can use this to our advantage and to our patients' advantage as well.
Very good. Now, Dr. Taylor and Ashlyn, we've covered a number of very important topics today. If there was one thing, one capstone piece of advice that you would want our listeners to walk away with, what would it be?
I think we have a lot of assumptions about nutrition and a lot of assumptions about what we think we know and what we think everybody else knows about eating healthy. And not everyone is on that same page, nor has the same capacity to make all the same choices that we would. So I think in this situation, with our roles in research and healthcare, is to understand their situation and become a facilitator for helping them make better choices, better decisions, and get better health outcomes. Because that's who they're looking to, is us to give them guidance. And with all of the other problems that we have to juggle when dealing with healthcare with individuals, we want to make sure that in this area that has a very distinct impact on health outcomes, that we can be the champion. And we don't have to be the answer, but we just have to say, this is an area of interest for you and an area of emphasis we need to focus. Let's get you to the expert. Let's get you to the dietitian to have that time. Because you don't have to be the answer to the question, but you just have to be able to identify and be the motivator.
I would like to encourage PAs to keep nutrition in the differential for patients, especially that are coming in for maybe some nonspecific complaints like fatigue or weakness, perhaps some musculoskeletal complaints or sleep disturbances, and especially addressing nutrition in recovery, like we talked about a little bit earlier. because as PAs, if we make discussing nutrition a priority, then our patients are much more likely to make nutrition a priority for themselves.
Thank you both very much for joining us today for this discussion. And that's it for another episode of Vital Minds. Be sure to visit the PA Foundation website at pa-foundation.org for more information about nutrition and specifically the NHANES data. The PA Foundation is the philanthropic arm of the American Academy of PAs. Our mission is to empower PAs to improve health through philanthropy and service. While you're at our website, catch up on any Vital Minds episodes you may have missed. Support for this episode of Vital Minds is provided by Abbott Nutrition. Until next time, everyone, I'm James Millward, and this is Vital Minds.